This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. March 13th, 2017. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Got a great program. I'm going to give you an overview of it before we kick it off here in this first segment. First, we're going to have Mike McKay, a former U.S. attorney, come and discuss with us the mainstream media's reaction to Attorney General Sessions' request or requirement that several attorneys resign their position from the federal government. The next, as we go into the bottom of the hour, I am going to take a little bit of liberty to give you my perspective on Shelby Steele's recent article where he talks about the exhaustion of liberalism. As we turn the corner at the bottom of the hour, we are going to then begin talking to you with, who do we have here? John Scruggs, senior legal counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. We're going to talk about the unfolding situation at the University of Wisconsin with regard to religious freedom. And then John Scruggs is going to stay with us as we head up to the last 15 minutes of the hour, and we'll do some Q&A on that particular story, or perhaps even some of the others that we've covered today. Remember that the call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. So on Friday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions asked for the resignations of 46 U.S. attorneys. While this process is standard procedure with incoming administrations, the mainstream media is portraying it as otherwise and somehow nefarious or suspect actions on the part of the Trump administration, as if this is abnormal. Joining us now is Mike McKay, a former U.S. attorney. He was appointed to the United States attorney position by President George W. Bush in October of 2001. Welcome to Washington Watch, Mike.
Thank you very much. I need to correct you, though, Dr. Piper. It was my brother John who was appointed in 2001. I was the United States attorney here in Seattle during President George H.W. Bush's administration, so I served from 1989 to 1993.
Well, thanks for that correction. I'm sorry for that mistake. Glad that I wasn't that far off, and I was giving both you and your brother a bit of a compliment, I suppose. Thanks for the correction. Let me go through a couple bullets and facts, if I may, and then I'm going to ask you a couple questions, Mike. Fact, the federal prosecutors are all holdovers from the Obama administration. Fact, it should be no surprise that there are people deep within the government left over from the last administration who have their own agenda. Fact, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush both dismissed dozens of U.S. attorneys in their first year in office. And then the final fact, in 1993, the firing of the U.S. attorneys under Clinton raised questions that it might impact the prosecution of then-Representative Don Rostenkowski. Jay Stevens, who had been a U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia under George H. Walker Bush, told reporters at the time that he was 30 days away from making a critical decision in the case. So, bottom line, Mike, isn't it common for U.S. attorneys to be replaced in the new presidential administrations, especially those of different parties?
Yes, it happens every 4 or 8 years. It happened to me when I left office in 1993, and I remember very well the discussions about the investigation of Congressman Rostenkowski, and there's speculation today about those kinds of things, but it's perfectly appropriate. President Trump and Attorney General Sessions certainly have the authority to do what they did, and any suggestion that this is impeding some kind of an investigation is sheer speculation right now.
Now, it seems obvious, but I'm going to ask you the question anyway. Why does an incoming president find it appropriate, or an incoming attorney general find it appropriate, to dismiss these attorneys that have been serving the previous administration? What's the logic?
Well, first, it's always good to turn over people in office. I mean, even when it's they're in the same political party. For instance, George H.W. Bush succeeded President Reagan, both are Republicans. And the U.S. attorney here in Seattle during the Reagan administration was asked to leave, and I was appointed to replace him. It's good to get fresh blood in there. Secondly, when it's a change in parties, it is good to have someone who is more loyal to the current president, more willing to execute the goals of the current president than one who might not be as supportive of the president. Now, I want to hasten to add, though, Dr. Piper, that you do leave politics at the door. When you become the United States Attorney, it's a huge honor, and it's a huge responsibility. And politics should play no role in charging decisions, for instance, criminal charges. It's not who you are or who you voted for. It's what you did or didn't do. And but nevertheless, when President George H.W. Bush became president in 89, he felt strongly about protecting the environment, about prosecuting bank fraud, about prosecuting drug dealers. And as a result, when I was the United States Attorney here in Seattle, I felt strongly about it as well.
Now, as I understand it, many of the U.S. attorneys have already departed since President Trump was inaugurated. What would cause the remaining few to still be holding on to their positions? Any theories on that?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just convenience. In March of 1993, I was still the U.S. attorney here in Seattle, even though President Clinton had already been inaugurated and was in the White House. I'd already announced I was leaving, but my job with a new law firm here in Seattle wasn't going to start until April, and that's when I left. And so I suspect, that, as you indicated, more than half of the presidentially appointed U.S. attorneys were gone on Friday, and the remaining 46 or so left, of course, on Friday. Those folks, I'm sure, had plans to move on, except for perhaps the U.S. attorney in New York, but the others, I'm sure, were making plans to move on. It is rare, but it happens every once in a while, that a U.S. attorney is held over for the entire term. It happened in Baltimore this past administration, and here in the Northwest, in Portland, Oregon, we had a U.S. attorney serve in two or three administrations of different parties.
Now, I know there are other professions that have a similar practice. For example, in college administration, when a president resigns or moves on, retires or whatnot, it is not uncommon at all for all of his vice presidents within that university to submit their resignations out of courtesy so that the new leadership can come in and either choose to ask them to apply and that basically stay on, or just accept their resignation and move on with different leadership. I assume that there's similar logic and courtesy in play in this whole story.
Well, I think it is even more so just because there's, you know, we have more than 200 years of practice. Here, and it is traditional that particularly when the administrations change parties, that the political appointees in the previous administration submit their resignations and be prepared to leave. I did. I announced the day after Clinton won the election in November of 1992. My plan was to move on.
Now, the action on Friday, came the day the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, comment on the theory of a deep state within the administration working against the White House. I'm pushing you on this one, but do you have any thoughts on that particular claim?
Oh, yeah, I don't think they're related at all. That's the conversations about deep state is a political conversation, and I think every new administration is worried about the holdovers. But I don't think that relates to U.S. attorneys. Every one of those U.S. attorneys should have known that they were going to move on, and having this part of some conspiratorial effort to get rid of people who have embedded into government, I just don't think they're related. It's time for new U.S. attorneys, and this should not be a surprise to anyone. I would say that giving someone less than a day's notice is a little rough. I think they should have. I wouldn't have handled it that way. I would have given someone a week or 10 days to move on, but certainly the president and the attorney general were well within their rights to do what they did on Friday.
Now, and again, another, especially when you're a political appointment or a political hire, would any of us really want to work for somebody that has diametrically opposing worldviews to our own? I would think there'd be a natural tension point between a new administration and the attorneys that worked for an old administration when these two administrations in many ways are polar opposites. Why would anybody want to stay on board if they're part of a mission, a vision, a direction that's antithetical to the values they hold dear?
Well, I agree with that. There's no reason why they would want to. And frankly, that's why I immediately announced, literally the day after the election in 92, that I was going to leave office. I did not support President Clinton. I didn't vote for him. And I thought he was entitled as president to choose who he thinks should be U.S. attorneys, not just here, but all over the country. Even though, by the way, I was approached by a Democratic member of Congress here in Washington State, who asked if I'd be interested in staying on. And I was flattered because, frankly, I did want to run, and I hope I did run, a nonpartisan professional office. But I do think that whoever the U.S. attorney is should be a supporter of the president, whoever's in the White House.
You see a double standard on how the media is covering today's news versus the history of presidents asking for these resignations and accepting them in the same numbers that Trump is currently requesting.
Yeah, there's always been a double standard. I think Republicans get the short end of the stick in the media a lot of the time. That's the hand that we've been dealt. So, we've got the White House and both houses of Congress. I think we're in pretty good shape right now. So, yeah, the media's been rough. I don't think they were nearly as rough on the Clinton administration in 1993, because those are parallels here. But we're always on the short end of the stick in that category.
You have any thoughts on Attorney General Sessions' decision to recuse himself from any investigation of Russian hacking and whatnot?
Well, I think, first, I know the Attorney General. He was the U.S. Attorney in one of the districts in Alabama when I was U.S. Attorney here. So I worked with him quite a bit. We served on committees together, and I have a lot of respect for him. There are two parts to the analysis. The first one is, does he really have a conflict of interest? Is this really something he should not be deciding because somehow during the campaign as a surrogate for then-candidate Trump, he had a communication with the Russians. There's a suggestion he met with the Russian ambassador a couple times. My guess is there wasn't really an actual reason for him to recuse himself. On the other hand, ours is a polarized society, and regardless of who is our attorney general, all of us as citizens should have a confidence that decisions, that investigations and charging decisions are based upon the facts of the law, not based upon what party you're in and who you voted for. So I, at the end of the day, think the Attorney General made the right decision. Not because he had to, but it helps restore confidence in justice. That's the name of the Department of Justice. So I think at the end of the day, I think he made the right decision, and I support him.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for joining us. I hear the transition music coming on in my ear, so I'm going to bid you a good afternoon and appreciate you joining us. Very informative, very educational with regard to these attorneys in the Justice Department. Again, thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.
This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. The call-in number is 866-372-7234. 866-372-7234. We'll be right back in a couple minutes after this break.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
How would you describe your health care? If you're like most Americans these days, the word affordable isn't top of mind. Well, here's some good news. There's actually a trusted healthcare option that is affordable. It's called MediShare. Unlike insurance, MediShare is Christian healthcare sharing, a community of more than 200,000 believers across America who share each other's medical expenses. It's about half the cost of insurance, and it's fully acceptable under the law. And here's the best part. Because MediShare is based on biblical principles, you never pay for things that go against your beliefs. MediShare is affordable healthcare for Christians.
Learn how thousands of Christians can help you save on your healthcare. For your free information guide, call 855-PSALM-23. Not available in Montana. MediShare, affordable biblical healthcare. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
Dan Celia of Financial Issues.
You know, there's probably never been a more important time in our economy to be thinking about a charitable gift annuity. I hope you'll do that just to shore up, to firm up some more income, permanent income, income that you can count on for the rest of your life while you're doing the Lord's work. A charitable gift annuity has been something I've been talking about for 25 years. Finally, we're seeing even mainstream start to get on board with the merits of charitable gift annuities. I hope you'll consider it. You can call the AFA Foundation. Someone there will help you work through the details and find out whether you qualify for a charitable gift annuity.
Call and speak with a representative of the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Family Research Council's Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, sitting in for Tony this afternoon. Again, the call-in number is 866-372-7234. If you want to follow Tony on Twitter, it's at T Perkins, which T-P-E-R-K-I-N-S. And the Family Research Council website is frc.org. Again, if you want to follow Tony, it's T Perkins. And the website for Family Research Council is frc.org. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Dr. Everett Piper. That's D-R-E-V-E-R-E-T-T-P-I-P-E-R. I'll repeat that. On Twitter, my handle is Dr. Everett Piper, D-R-E-V-E-R-E-T-T-P-I-P-E-R. And if you want to follow me on my website, it's Oklahoma Wesleyan University. That's www.okwu.edu. I want to use this segment to talk about Shelby Steele's article, his column, in the Wall Street Journal. It's a column titled "The Exhaustion of American Liberalism," where Shelby Steele talks about the exhaustion of white guilt. Here's a quote, a couple paragraphs from his article. "The recent flurry of marches, demonstrations, and even riots, along with the Democratic Party's spiteful reaction to the Trump presidency, exposes what modern liberalism has become: a politics shrouded in pathos. Unlike the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, when protesters wore their Sunday best and carried themselves with heroic dignity, today's liberal marches are marked by incoherence and downright lunacy. Hats designed to evoke sexual organs, poems that scream in anger yet have no point to make, and an hysterical anti-Americanism. All this suggests lostness, the end of something rather than the beginning. And what is ending? America, since the 1960s, has lived through what might be called an age of white guilt. We may still be in this age, but the Trump election suggests an exhaustion with the idea of white guilt and with the drama of culpability, innocence, and correctness in which it mires us. This liberalism evolved with a society shamed by its past, but that shame has weakened now. Our new conservative president rolls his eyes when he is called a racist, and we all, liberal and conservative alike, know that he isn't one. The jig is up, unquote. Liberalism is exhausted because it has become corrupted. Shelby Steele is spot on. The very fact that liberalism has become progressivism and that liberalism now demands conformity rather than arguing for liberty is evidence that it is no longer classically liberal. I've talked with you and to you about this before on this program. Classical liberalism, if you want to use my industry as a model, the Liberal Arts Academy, would go back to, let's say, Oxford 1,000 years ago and its founding. And why was it established? Why was Oxford University created? To educate a free man and a free woman, to liberate culture, liberate society, liberate a culture, a country, a church, and a people. The Liberal Arts Academy was an education for freedom and liberty and justice and righteousness, and it was grounded in the time-tested truths of God, those self-evident truths that are endowed to us by our Creator and not made up or contrived by the power base or the populace. The classical liberal recognized that liberty always presupposes a law with a capital L, and that the lawgiver is the giver of liberty, and that those that need to follow God and honor His laws, His ways, His reasons, and His revelation, those people that do so are those that are truly going to be free, and those people who resist those ways, those laws, those revelations, are going to be prone to power and popularity, the podium, the pulpit, and they're not going to be governed by principles. They're going to exercise their power over everyone else. So in other words, classical liberalism presupposes law. Like I've said before on this program, G.K. Chesterton, when you get rid of the big laws of God, you don't get liberty, but rather thousands upon thousands of little laws that rush in to fill the vacuum. And that's what we see today with the loss of classical liberalism, which has been replaced by progressivism. Progressivism is always grounded in people and power, and liberalism, classically, is always grounded in the conservation of liberty, as those liberties are grounded in God's laws. I wrote a book a few years ago, and I titled it, Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. Why did I title it that? It's because as a conservative, I believe in conserving the time-tested truths of God that give us the context for liberty in the first place. I am a liberal because I believe that the best education is one that liberates. It liberates us from the consequences of those things that are wrong and frees us to live within the beauty of those things that are right. I'm a classical liberal because of my passion for the liberal arts, an education that's driven by a hunger for answers rather than the protection of opinions. I am a liberal because I believe in freedom, freedom of thought and expression, and freedom to dissent from the consensus. I am a liberal because I believe in integration. Truth cannot be segregated into false dichotomies, but it is an integrated whole. The liberally educated person recognizes that we cannot and should not separate personal life from private life, and the head from heart, fact from faith, and belief from behavior. I'm a liberal because I believe in conservation. There are ideas that are tested by time and defended by reason and validated by experience and confirmed by revelation, and these ideas should be conserved. I am a liberal because I recognize that when we exchange the truth of God for a lie, we basically live in a house of cards. Classical liberalism believes in liberty. It's the antithesis of slavery, and it is the context for freedom. Shelby Steele is spot on. The exhaustion of American liberalism is that it has died, and it has died a death at the hands of progressivism. Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins, 866-372-7234. We'll take a commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by John Scruggs to discuss the University of Wisconsin video.
Yeah. making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
A lot of economic news coming out this week. Of course, the big news will be Federal Reserve will raise rates in all likelihood. I guess there is a slight possibility that they won't, but everything is pointing to that. There was only one dissent vote out of the Fed president. So they will likely raise rates. We knew that back in December. I said it in December they were going to raise in March. They say the markets are waiting for that. I don't believe that. We won't know that until after the rate hike. But I believe that it's either factored in or the markets will consider it pretty irrelevant. And I think it's the latter. So I don't think it's going to matter much. On Tuesday, of course, we get PPI, Core Producer Price Index. It's expected to be up about 0.2%. Then on Wednesday, we get Core CPI. That's also, that would be Core CPI, Consumer Price Index. That's expected to be up 0.2%. Of course, this adding to the inflation, moving us a bit closer to the 2% Fed goal. We get Empire manufacturing numbers on Wednesday, retail sales numbers. That's going to be interesting. I don't expect it to be anywhere near where it was last month. And crude oil inventory is also something that we'll watch for whatever reason, because that has just gone up and up. We've seen record crude oil inventories now for the last 2 weeks. Housing starts, that'll give us some indication. The big number on Friday, industrial production and Michigan sentiment number, they will be important numbers to watch.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
Hey, this is Dr. Everett Piper coming back in for Tony Perkins here. We had a little bit of a glitch there because of a power outage, I think. So I assume you can all hear me and that we're ready to go on this one. Forgive that slight delay. Again, call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. What we have right now is our guest is John Scruggs. He is a attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom. And what I would like to cover with him right now is this story at the University of Wisconsin. Basically, the story is as follows. The University of Wisconsin-Madison had recently there was a man-on-the-street interview. And in this man-on-the-street interview, students were asked if they had difficulty with forcing a Muslim, for example, to participate in a Christian service, perform a song, at a Christian church, engage in other religious ceremonies that were Christian in nature, should that Muslim be forced to do that? The response is very telling. But then at the end of this interview, this man on the street interview, students are asked an interesting question. This is a 2 minute and 30 second sound clip, but I want you to listen to this audio as the context for our time with John Scruggs.
So there was a dress designer that turned down Melania Trump to design her dress. She opted out. Do you think that she has the right to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Do you think it's okay for her to do that?
Yeah.
You should be able to control your business in that regard, yeah.
Okay. You have the right to opt out of business that you might not want to associate yourself with.
Yes.
Okay. So if you were, let's say, a Muslim singer here in Madison and a church approached you for an Easter service for you to sing, do you have the right to opt out of that?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you have the right to opt out of doing whatever you want.
That seems like such an unusual circumstance that they would want them, like that the Christian church would want to force a Muslim singer to sing at their church if they didn't want to.
I would feel like if I was Muslim, it would be hard to work with someone.
Yeah, if that goes against your religious views, I feel like you have the right to turn that down.
Okay. So there's actually a city ordinance that would allow those groups to sue you by opting out, by turning down their request. Do you think that's a good law?
Probably not.
So the law is saying what now, that the Muslim singer can opt out?
Can't opt out.
Cannot opt out. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's what the law says? Yeah.
Do you think that's an okay law?
I don't believe so, no. No, not at all. I feel like that goes against people's rights.
So pretty much, do you think that a law should exist that would force somebody to do the work?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So let's say you're a Christian photographer here in Madison,
and
someone approached you to do a same-sex wedding. Would that be hateful or discriminatory to opt out of that?
I don't know.
Do you have the right to do that?
In that situation, probably not, because that would bring up some legal issues, I would suspect.
Like that city ordinance, right?
Yes, yeah.
The one that you didn't agree with?
Yeah.
If it was switched to, like, Christian views or something, they wouldn't be able to do that. And also, I don't know, I just think it should be, like, fair all around.
I think it's very difficult to determine what reason it is that you make that decision, unless you're very steadfast in your religion saying, no, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. In which case, that's, you're a jerk for doing that.
So your political views, your ideas and kind of worldview is okay to say no to business, but your religious views aren't?
No.
That's such a sticky issue.
Amazing. Now, because of the glitch at the front end of this segment, we're going to have to take a break in about 60 seconds. In fact, I'm going to have to take a break before we actually even introduce Mr. Scruggs for further conversation. So, John, hold on. We're going to ask you to hold through the break. And callers, we may have time at the end of the next segment for you to engage with John Scruggs a bit on this particular story. This is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony Perkins. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Whoa, we have not had a response like this before. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We've been doing these spiritual heritage tours for like 20 years. We're sold out for June already, if you can believe that. We've got space left on our September tours of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We call them spiritual heritage tours, and I don't know how long these September seats will last. To what do you attribute that to, someone might ask? Maybe it's the fact that we have a new person occupying the White House. Maybe that has something to do with it. But in any event, we welcome you to come with us on our September Spiritual Heritage Tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Those are two separate trips. You can do both, or you can do one or the other. We'd love to have you. Go to spiritualheritagetours.com. spiritualheritagetours.com.
God has uniquely gifted you for His purposes. You are wired for good works. Volunteering with Operation Christmas Child directly connects you with God's global purposes. By serving year-round, you further the proclamation of the gospel in more than 150 countries through a simple gift-filled shoebox. To learn more about local, year-round opportunities to make disciples, or to apply, visit SamaritansPurse.org/volunteer with OCC.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
American Family Radio, impacting lives.
Hi, my name is Sandra, and I'm from Selma, Alabama, and I'm calling to just share with you that AFR has helped me this morning because my brother has just recently had a stroke, and he's in the hospital in Tuscaloosa, and the words that were shared this morning, the Bible verses, that greater is he who is in me than he who is in the world, and I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You know, I've heard these words just coming in to Tuscaloosa this morning, and I just praise God and thank you for sharing those words with me at this time in my life. Thank you.
Ensure that we impact even more lives by partnering with us during our 3-day share-a-thon starting April 4th. Listener-supported American Family Radio, boldly standing for truth for your family.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Obviously, this is Dr. Everett Piper sitting in for Tony this afternoon. Call in number is 866-372-7234. Again, I apologize for the glitch at the bottom of the hour there. We had a power outage here in Oklahoma, which caused everything to go dead on me. So bless the producers back there in Washington, D.C. for doing a great work. But I think we're all back on the same page now. Again, if you want to follow Tony on Twitter, it's T. Perkins. If you want to follow me, it's Dr. Everett Piper. That's D-R-E-V-E-R-E-T-T-P-I-P-E-R. All right, we got plenty of time to talk with John Scruggs, who is the Senior Legal Counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for your patience on that segment that we just skipped on through. But we've got plenty of time right now, I think, to give you a chance to talk to us about this crazy story. Everyone in this particular Man on the Street interview agreed that a creative professional should have the foundational freedom to decline work that was in conflict with his or her religious beliefs when the religion was Islam. But when faced with a situation that goes against the current cultural expectations, like a Christian photographer declining to promote a same-sex wedding, i.e. a religious service, it's known as a sacrament of the church, I might add, the gears start grinding and they actually say that's such a sticky issue. I just want to turn you loose. How do you respond to this?
Well, it is a bit crazy. I think it's amazing to see the logical inconsistencies on video to come out loud and clear. It's a shame, I think, in one sense, that you see such inconsistencies, but that really has real-world impact on Christians who are in the creative professions who can't live out their faith, can't promote their beliefs, and they're being forced by unjust laws to violate their consciences. So it really is shocking. And just to give you a little context for the video, these things are not hypotheticals. The reason we went to University of Madison is because there is a Madison law that we recently filed a lawsuit that we're challenging that requires all those type of things. It would require the Muslim to sing at a Christian church. It would require a Christian photographer, and that's who we're representing, a photographer and blogger, to promote same-sex marriage on her own website. And I think what you see is freedoms go together, that if one person and one group of people don't have freedom, then no one does. And that's essentially what this lawsuit is challenging, and I think the video kind of highlights the fact that there is this hypocrisy slash internal inconsistency out in the wider culture and even in the media.
And you could come up with a dozen of these hypotheticals and these anecdotes, and I'm just going to mention a few. as rhetorical questions. Should the owner of a Jewish deli be required to sell pork from the local farmer? Should the local Hindu be required to, the local Hindu owner of a marketing firm, should he be required to advertise beef for the beef industry? Should the Muslim owner of a marketing firm be required to promote Charlie Hebdo cartoons on a billboard campaign? I think we all agree the answer is obviously no. These people should not have to participate in something that violates their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's why we're filing lawsuits all across the country, not just in Madison, where we represent this photographer and blogger, but in Phoenix, Arizona, we represent an art studio. In Minnesota, a film production studio. In Colorado, a website design company. All of them just want to do what most Americans think and they have the freedom to do, which is just promote the beliefs and messages that only you agree with, and not to be forced by the government to promote messages that you disagree with. It really is a shame that we have to file these lawsuits to establish that freedom, but it seems often that the people who are being thrown under the bus here are Christians who just can't live out their faith.
All right. So in your opinion, I mean, you're at the point of the spear. Why is our current culture so inconsistent and confused when it comes to religious freedom for a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Hindu, but they aren't willing to grant or concede the same religious freedom to an evangelical Christian or a conservative Catholic? Why have we come to this point in the United States of America where this inconsistency for the First Amendment, for religious freedom, and for the right of every individual to practice his faith consistently without the impediment of the government imposing upon him or her, why can't we see common sense as the way out of this?
Well, it's a good question. I think a lot of it has to do just with the wider media, especially in university culture, where you see kind of sexual ethics kind of override everything. They're the trump card are the trump card on basic liberties and freedoms that we've all taken for granted. And it's taking these individuals, these brave individuals who represent, to stand up, to fight against the government, to say, no, this is not right. That everyone, and this is not just about the beliefs and rights of Christians. It's about the beliefs and rights of everybody, just to live out and not to be forced by the government to essentially betray who they are. And hopefully that message is getting out more and more with the videos like you've seen, the inconsistency. Why does it make any sense for people to applaud the designer not to make something for the First Lady, but people criticize the Christian photographer? It really makes no sense. And it goes to show that freedom goes together, that everyone needs to have these types of freedoms to live according to their conscience, or no one does.
Now, I'm going to ask you to tell me something good here, to quote Chaka Khan, the great scholar and philosopher. Tell me something good. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel where we'll see that these positions formerly held, or perhaps currently held, by Chai Feldblum, who tells us that in situations where there's conflict between sexual liberty and religious freedom, she sees no situation where religious freedom should prevail. And she was a nominee but for the EEOC by President Obama. We see Donald Verrilli in the Obergefell case saying that Christian universities indeed might find their tax-exempt status in jeopardy because of this new definition of marriage, and these Christian universities, such as my own, will not compromise the religious convictions that marriage is between a man and a woman and sexual fidelity should be held within that context. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel that these inconsistencies, such as this video of yours, are going to cause a light bulb to go on in the minds of our Supreme Court justices, and they're going to say, aha, we were wrong?
Well, for some people, that light bulb probably will never go on. But I think for the mass, I hope, and I think this is right, for the vast majority of kind of common sense Americans, they'll see these inconsistencies. And the good news is we have the First Amendment. These types of principles have already been upheld under the First Amendment in various contexts and in various cases. And those are the exact cases that we're relying on, that no longer are people in the creative profession just waiting around to get sued. but they're actually taking a preemptive step and saying, hey, we need to, you know, go to a court and establish our rights right now to see what we can do. And that's really, you see a movement all across the country of people in the creative businesses, whether it be photographers, artists, filmmakers, all those people standing up and saying, hey, we have the right to operate our business in accordance with our beliefs. Establishing is really a fundamental principle that commissioned artists and commissioned photographers, other creatives, should not be compelled by the government under the force, even though sometimes of jail, to violate their consciences. So we are very hopeful to have this wave of lawsuits going on all across the country, and we fully expect to win all of them eventually, even if it means going to the United States Supreme Court.
Now, you're listening to John Scruggs. He's the senior legal counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. And remember that the call-in number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I welcome your calls during this segment because you have an opportunity to ask one of our lead legal scholars in the nation with regard to religious freedom and First Amendment rights what you should be doing in the public square to express your opinions and your concerns, and perhaps even how to counteract and confront someone or some organization if they're imposing on your religious freedom and your constitutional rights. John, I'm going to give you a little plug here, and you can respond accordingly. For the listeners, Alliance Defending Freedom has represented Oklahoma Wesleyan University, my institution, at the highest levels of the land. You've represented me at the Supreme Court with regard to the abortifacient mandate. Oklahoma Wesleyan University is a co-litigant with the Little Sisters of the Poor. And I want everybody to know that had it not been for you, the Little Sisters probably would have been left dangling. Likewise, Oklahoma Wesleyan University. Here we are, a pro-life organization where every person that works at Oklahoma Wesleyan University indicates at the point of employment that they are pro-life. But yet the federal government is telling the women that work at Oklahoma Wesleyan University that they're too stupid to make up their own minds on what kind of drugs and contraception they want in their health care, and that they have to include products that they don't want and will never use. Now, what in the world, who in the world is more misogynistic here and disrespectful of women? Oklahoma Wesleyan, who gives them the liberty to work here because they want to and their convictions are honored accordingly, or the federal government that dishonors them and says, you must buy this product even though you don't want it? Likewise, the Little Sisters of the Poor. They're nuns. They don't need any contraception, my land, let alone abortifacient drugs. Why in the world is the federal government telling them otherwise? John, thank you, and thank the Alliance Defending Freedom for representing us.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that, and it's really our honor to represent great clients like, you know, your university, like our clients. I personally represent these photographers and kind of bakers and florists and web designers and all these people want to do. They just want to live out their lives according with their faith, according to their conscience, and that really is such a preeminent issue of the day that whether it be from the government or from wider culture, that people putting pressure to sacrifice on people of faith, to sacrifice their faith. And it's just really an honor to see people stand up and say, no, you know, we could comply, we could kind of go quietly into the night, but no, we're going to stand up for our rights, and not just for the rights of ourselves, but for the rights of others, for the rights of our children. It really is awe-inspiring, so it's really our honor to represent great clients like you.
Alliance Defending Freedom again. And folks, if you have any discretionary money to give to contributions, charitable giving, if you have any discretionary charitable giving, consider the Alliance Defending Freedom. They do an excellent job of representing all of us. The list goes on and on of those that they are representing right now, like I said, even at the highest levels of the United States legal system. We do have a caller. Charles from Missouri, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, I think both of you and Tony Perkins for what you do. Thank you for allowing our voice and our freedoms to be actually worked out and seen for God in the Constitution.
Thanks, Charles.
My question was...
Yeah, what question do you have of John? Go ahead.
What they're all trying to take away is they're eventually going to make it to where our government's a dictatorship instead of a government run by the people. How do we work through the law through the right way instead of feel the persecution? And what's the best way that people can be active about, other than signing petitions and stuff like that in their own state, or getting our voices out?
Great question, Charles. Great question.
I think it's a really good question. I think you have to be involved where you can be in the local government. And I think an example of this, the lawsuit we filed against Madison, many of the people on the video you saw didn't even know this law was even in place in the city of Madison. But it's in place, and it's severely restrictive and very broad. But if someone had gone to those city council meetings and stood up at those meetings and said, no, this is not right, if enough people would have done that, maybe that law would never would have passed. Maybe the people, the artists in the city of Madison would never have felt the restrictions under that law. So it really is about being cognizant, being aware, being involved. And you can do that in so many multiple ways, being involved in local government, going to ADF's website. We try to inform as many people as we can about the religious liberty issues that are so important today. But it's really about just being involved and standing up for what you believe in those contexts.
Thanks, John. Mike in Tennessee, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, John, and thank you for taking my call. I issue that stands out in my mind was the family out in the Pacific Northwest where they were, you know, they're a cake factory or, you know,
a
they
bakery.
Bake cakes. And they, yeah, same-sex couple, and they ended up being sued and fined, and I thought the fine was exorbitant. It was like $125,000. It was way out of bounds on what you would expect from a city ordinance to be. You know, they basically were trying to put them out of business. So that really bothered me, and I was wondering if we could advocate for a religious liberty freedom bill or something in that, you know, to that effect.
All right. Thank you, Mike. John, I think he basically is hinting at the RFRA acts that are taking place across the nation. Is that the way you read this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And those bills are vitally important. The one, I think, in Mississippi and various places across the country, there's even a federal bill being considered. So those are definitely things that people need to write in and, you know, encourage, be cognizant of, and that really could make a big difference. And as the caller did note, some of these local laws have very severe penalties. Some of them have criminal penalties. I know the one in Phoenix carries a six-month jail time if you violate the law. And some of them have excessive monetary penalties. We represent a floral artist in Washington who not only is she being fined, but she's being fined in her personal capacity. Although she has a corporation, the law goes directly to her personal assets. So everything she owns is on the line because of attorney's fees that she faces. So these have some severe penalties, which is just unbelievable.
John, you've been very gracious. Thanks for sticking with me through these transitions this afternoon, and thanks for all the work that the Alliance Defending Freedom does in defending religious freedom across the nation. This is Everett Piper, Dr. Everett Piper, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon on Washington Watch. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your questions and your call-ins, and thank you for your courage and your commitment. Blessings to all of you as you continue to fight the good fight, and we'll see you this Thursday when I return to Washington Watch again. Blessings.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.